This week on The Wheelhouse. Abortion access. And a little later, the final day of Connecticut's legislative session. This is The Wheelhouse, the show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond, right here. And later this month marks 1 year since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. In the weeks and months since, we've seen states across the country roll back abortion access. In states like Georgia, abortion now banned at about 6 weeks of pregnancy, before many people even know that they're pregnant. At the same time, here in Connecticut, we're seeing access expanded. For more on that, we've got really three great guests we're proud to bring to you this week. Joining us all via Zoom, we have Deb Brzezinski, who is the Professor of Public Health and Undergraduate Coordinator at Southern Connecticut State University. Thank you for joining us this morning, Deb.
Good morning.
Christine Stewart, Editor-in-Chief, CT News Junkie, good friend of ours. Thank you for coming on today, Christine.
No problem.
And Sarah McCammon, thank you so much for joining us from NPR, National Correspondent. Thank you so much for coming on the show this morning, Sarah.
Sure. Good morning.
If you're listening to this conversation, you want to join in, give us a call, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677. Sarah, you get the first question. It's been almost 1 year since the Dobbs decision, as I just mentioned in that open. How do things look now, broadly speaking, when it comes to abortion access?
Well, it's important to remember that even before the Dobbs decision, there were lots of places in the country where it was very difficult to get an abortion. Even in states where abortion was legal, there were several states that had just one clinic left. And, you know, broad swaths of the country, people would have to travel to reach a clinic. That said, the situation has changed dramatically over the past year since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade with the Dobbs decision last June 24th. A dozen states have banned nearly all abortions, some of those without exceptions for rape or incest, and often with very narrow and ambiguous medical exceptions for medical emergencies. Others have implemented, as you just mentioned, you know, limits at various stages. You mentioned Georgia's ban at approximately 6 weeks before many people know they're pregnant. Nebraska just passed a 12-week ban. And other states we've seen in this last legislative session that's been wrapping up in many states over the past several weeks have also passed new legislation. For example, North Carolina, a 12-week ban that takes effect in July. And then others have states have legislation tied up in litigation, places like Florida. At the same time, some states have passed protections for abortion providers and for patients.
And that's
and what
where,
this means is that
go ahead,
patients,
sorry.
Lots of, and quickly, what this means for patients and providers is that many patients are traveling. Others are trying to access abortion via medication abortion, and some providers and clinics have had to either shut down or move to other states.
Is it something like, Sarah, 19 states, I believe, that are moving to restrict abortion access, and then I think you said 12, maybe 13, that have near total bans?
That's about right. Yeah, there. You know, it depends on how you define an abortion ban, because again, some of them are based on gestational limits or other indicators. But it's about a dozen that have near total bans, and close to 20 that have significant restrictions, according to organizations like the Guttmacher Institute and Center for Reproductive Rights.
And as we talk about states that are trying to expand access or at least codify these protections into law, let's go to Christine Stewart. How would you characterize abortion access here in our state?
Well, abortion has been codified in Connecticut state law since 1990. So we have some pretty good protections. And so I think the last legislative session, we saw them begin to reach out to protect medical providers who would be giving reproductive care to women who traveled from other states. This year, they had a bill that strengthened that to prevent these providers from being disciplined or adversely affected by any Connecticut licensing agency if they ended up a doctor from another state who was disciplined for providing an abortion to a patient came to Connecticut, they should be allowed to practice and their license shouldn't be impacted. And so we also have, as far as Connecticut goes, they did pass a bill that would allow for pharmacists to prescribe birth control. And so those were kind of the two big things that they did this year.
Deb, join in on a conversation. What do you think about what Christine and Sarah have had to say so far?
Both are on target. And I think, you know, that lays the foundation for what's happening right now, with some states being more protective and others not. We're going to see, like, it's the next steps. It's what's the impact on the public health system. You know, the more we provide access to family planning and contraception, the less abortions are needed anyway. And so making sure there's education and access will already lower the need for that. And, you know, we have to also think beyond and what's going to happen to, as one of them mentioned, you know, with providers leaving states, we're going to see a lot of issues in some of those states down the line. There's the immediate impact of access for the women, but then we have these long-term impacts of access to care for everybody, inequities expanding, and lots of other problems that are going to continue to happen based on these laws, because this is really just step one without thinking about the long-term implications.
Sarah, how does what's happening here in Connecticut, as you've heard, how does that compare to other states? I don't want to put pressure on you here, but I don't know. We like to hear from our governor that we're a national leader on this. Just help us understand if Connecticut is doing the best job that they can on this front.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, some states have protections in place, and some of them have put protections in place recently for abortion providers and patients, as we were just discussing. I mean, the Guttmacher Institute, which is a research group that supports abortion rights and has some of the best data on this kind of thing, they rate the state of Connecticut as protective on their sort of a sliding scale of most restrictive to most protective. It's on the protective side of things, and I think that's in part because of some of the protections that you just mentioned. Now, other states have gone further. You know, some states like California, Washington, New York, and Massachusetts have stockpiled abortion pills in anticipation of some of the challenges that could unfold around litigation related to the abortion pill mifepristone. Other states have put in place some funding for training providers, things like that. But as we mentioned, you know, the Connecticut's governor did sign a law last year protecting abortion seekers and providers from out-of-state lawsuits. We've seen states like Hawaii and Colorado pass similar measures. Colorado and others have required insurance plans, for example, to cover abortions. So different states have dealt with this in different ways, but we've certainly seen an intensification of the division between, you know, different state policies. Where you live really determines your access today.
Incredible analysis there from Sarah McCammon, who joins us from NPR today. We're also joined by Christine Stewart of CT News Junkie and Deb Brzezinski, who is a professor of public health at Southern Connecticut State University. You want to join us in on the conversation? Give us a call, 888-720-9677. I'm going to read that one more time, 888-720-9677. Deb, you alluded to education and access. Who most needs to access or have improved access to abortion care in Connecticut, reproductive care as a whole?
So in Connecticut, and also just nationally, the people who are most impacted by these laws are people who are either individuals from minority populations. We see that access to care and the insurance and all the things that would go into paying for that, as well as people who are low income. So that's really where we need to focus on helping people get access, even within our state, who has readily. We do have one county in our state that does not have a clinic. So just making sure that we're accessing the right individuals, because those, again, at the lower income and from minority populations are being most impacted by these laws in a negative manner.
Frankie, this is Christine.
Jump in.
I don't know if either of the guests have an answer for this, but are we actually going to see More providers come to the state of Connecticut and set up shop and practice, and you know, possibly expand access for women across the state.
This is Sarah. Oh, go ahead, Deb, if you'd like.
As I say, I think we might. We're seeing there's a lot of movement around the country of a lot of practitioners in states with these very strict laws who are being punished already, who are leaving their practices and setting up shop. There was an article about some medical clinicians who were maternal and fetal specialists leaving. I'm pretty sure it's Idaho. And so they were going and setting up shop in close by states. It's going to be interesting to see if people come more here, because we're already in a sea of protective states, but the clinicians are leaving their states and they are going to states. And I also read a study about doctors who are going into residency practices, and they are the desire to go to states with bans is dropped significantly. So they're not even wanting to do their training there in OB or emergency care. So they're going to have to go somewhere for their training and for their practices if they leave these states. So we may see additional clinics coming here, is just my guess based on what's happening in other states and people needing to do that.
Sarah, can you weigh in?
Yeah, just to sort of echo what Deb just said, I mean, Connecticut, of course, is surrounded by states like Massachusetts, Vermont, New York, New Jersey, which all of which are rated as protective to one degree or another. And so, what we have seen for the most part is providers, particularly abortion clinics that can no longer operate in red states, tending to move to states that are closer to places where there's a greater need. So a lot of movement toward New Mexico, which, you know, is right next, of course, to Texas and to Oklahoma, which are some of the most restrictive states in the country. Arizona, that has been moving in the more restrictive direction. We've also, I think, seen some providers move to Colorado. Illinois has become a real hub in the Midwest because it's also surrounded by states with considerable restrictions. So, I'm not sure that Connecticut is not a state I'd put at the top of the list of places where providers are likely to move. That said, it is a protective environment. There may be those who have, personal reasons for wanting to go there. And the medical training for, up and coming doctors, and especially OBGYNs, is a real concern I've heard from my sources. In order for doctors to be trained, even if they don't plan on being abortion providers, there are situations in which OB-GYNs and other providers need to know how to terminate a pregnancy for medical reasons, for emergency reasons, right? And they don't have the opportunity to be exposed to that in states where abortion is illegal. So this is a real concern that I've heard from the medical community as well.
Christine, yeah, I got a question. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, jump in.
I think that's where we're going to see the training, the medical professionals coming here, at least for training. We may see that may be more of an increase where they come practice here, because it is a critical piece of OBGYN training is to learn how to do this procedure. It is a medical procedure. And so, backing what Sarah says, I think that may be where we see more of an influx.
Well, what's interesting is that what we're also seeing in Connecticut is at least three rural hospitals have shut down their maternity wards. And so, is there a need for these doctors and for this care in other settings? But obviously, the full spectrum of care involves the ability to be able to terminate.
Earlier this year here in Connecticut, Governor Ned Lamont announced that he would commit Connecticut to join the Reproductive Freedom Alliance. Christine, what can you tell us about that? What exactly does that alliance do? What is it?
The Reproductive Freedom Alliance, I am not sure, Frankie. You have stumped me on that one.
Is this something you've ever heard about, Sarah, this freedom, Reproductive Freedom Alliance? Is this like a national kind of caucus of states?
I've heard of it. I think it's my understanding. I haven't done a lot of reporting on it, but it's a coalition of governors and perhaps attorneys general. I think primarily governors from mostly blue states that are supportive of abortion rights. And, on that note, we were talking a moment ago about the division in sort of access and policy between, for lack of a better term, red and blue states, right? And the intensification of, protections for access in more progressive states and deepening restrictions in more conservative states. And, you know, as part of that, we have seen attorneys general as well from some of these states come together and, you know, file litigation designed to, you know, protect abortion rights. I think we're going to talk later probably about abortion pills a little bit more and the mifepristone litigation I mentioned earlier. But, you know, 17 attorneys general from blue states essentially have come together to try to protect access, even as, you know, efforts from abortion opponents are moving in the other direction. So, yeah, we've definitely seen state governors and attorneys general working together on this issue.
Yeah, let's go there, Christine.
Can I? I was going to say, I do know about the Reproductive Freedom Alliance.
Go ahead, Deb. Thank you.
Yeah. So I did do a little reading on it. It's right now 21 governors have signed on. It's nonpartisan. I think it started from what it sounds like in California. It's funded both by the California Wellness Foundation and the Rosenberg Foundation. So it is among the governors. Governor Lamont did sign on and has a quote on their webpage. All the governors who signed on have a quote, and he has a long one about protecting freedom, reproductive freedom, and why we got involved with this.
Hey, Christine, we were just talking about attorney generals and mifepristone. We had our attorney general, William Tong, weigh in on this. What was he saying? And what has Connecticut done to move forward to try to protect access to mifepristone?
Yeah, Connecticut has filed an amicus brief in this matter, along with, I believe it was 17 other states, in order to protect access to this medication. But like Sarah said, I don't have any knowledge that the state of Connecticut has started stockpiling the medication. So that could be something that they look at when they finish this session.
Sarah, access to mifepristone, why such a big target?
Right. Well, mifepristone is the first drug in the two-drug protocol that was approved by the FDA for termination of pregnancy, generally in the first trimester. It was approved back in 2000. This is a two-drug regimen. So mifepristone first, followed by another drug called misoprostol. Now, misoprostol can be used alone to terminate pregnancies. The World Health Organization says it's a safe way to do it. But most doctors, particularly here in the U.S., prefer this two drug protocol. It's more predictable, it's more efficient, it's usually less painful for the patient. And, you know, back in 2000, when the Food and Drug Administration first approved this drug, it was very controversial, it was very political, and it's continued to be a source of controversy over the years. In recent years, it's become the abortion pill in general has become, you know, much more commonly used. It now makes up a majority of abortions in the US. And again, most medication abortions are done using these two drugs that include mifepristone, which is the focus of litigation filed last year by a coalition of anti-abortion groups. They filed in Amarillo, Texas, where they knew there was a very conservative Trump-appointed judge in charge of things. And essentially, this case has been working its way through the court system in recent months. The goal of these abortion rights opponents is to take mifepristone off the market, which would mean that, again, the gold standard protocol for medication abortion, the dominant form of abortion in the U.S., would potentially no longer be available. There are some alternatives we can talk about. But it's become a target because it is in such widespread use, because it's a choice that a lot of patients make. And frankly, it's much harder to regulate. I mean, there's the legal access to this pill, but there's also a lot of sort of extra legal, questionably legal, you know, you can get pills online, you can get them a variety of ways. And there's a lot of evidence people are doing that in pretty large numbers, particularly in states with abortion restrictions. So for all of those reasons, the pill has really become, I think, the new front in this battle. It's no longer primarily about clinics. Although, particularly as a pregnancy progresses and for complicated pregnancies, you know, surgical and clinic care is preferred for a lot of patients. I don't want to minimize that, but it's no longer, you know, the battle for many years was, you saw it out in front of abortion clinics with picketers and protesters, and that's not really the primary focus anymore.
Is misoprostol the alternative, just taking that one drug regimen instead of the two drug, or is there other alternatives? What are your thoughts there, Sarah?
You know, there are a few other protocols out there. The one that's, I think, has the most support from the medical community is misoprostol alone. Generally, that involves taking more doses of the misoprostol. And But the downside of that is that often for many patients, it's somewhat less effective, not by a huge degree, but there's evidence it's less effective than with mifepristone. And again, there's often heavier cramping, bleeding. It's sometimes more painful, and again, less predictable, less efficient than taking the mifepristone. Because what mifepristone does is it essentially stops the body from producing the hormones needed to sustain a pregnancy. So it shuts the process down, for lack of a better term. And misoprostol actually brings on, termination of the pregnancy. It's also used in induction of labor sometimes and other gynecological procedures. As doctors, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a lawyer, but as doctors have explained it to me, this two-drug protocol just tends to work better for most patients. And that's why it's preferred. And it's, you know, by far the dominant approach in the U.S.
Before we finish up this segment, Deb, I want to ask you, we're going to take a break here in a second. How worried should we be about access to medication abortion, both, I guess, in Connecticut and beyond? Is there cause for concern?
There is, because this is one of those pieces that closes the gap for people with access issues, and not just in states without who have banned it, where we can get the medicines in, but even in areas like we're talking about Connecticut and rural areas, this allows more access. So we should be worried about it. The FDA has proven over and over and over in all the studies that it is safe to use. It has better safety measures than a lot of medicines that are out there used for regular stuff. And so it has nothing to do with a medical piece to why we're trying to get rid of it, but it is going to cause access problems significantly for especially women in rural areas where they don't have as much clinic access.
Thank you so much for that, Deb. I appreciate it. You're listening to Connecticut Public Radio and The Wheelhouse. You can join the conversation after a short break, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677. Back with more on abortion access in a moment.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Hartford HealthCare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers, so we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford HealthCare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
You're listening to The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about abortion access in Connecticut and beyond. In the year since Roe v. Wade was overturned, that one-year marker is June 24th. Still with me are Deborah Ziske's professor of public health, and she's also an undergraduate coordinator at Southern Connecticut State University, Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief, CT News Junkie, and Sarah McCammon, national correspondent for NPR. Join the conversation if you want to talk to us, 888-720-9677. Deb, in Connecticut, there's these efforts to create something called a Safe Harbor Fund. What's the idea there?
So what we're trying to do there is make sure that we have the laws. It's creating these laws that are helping clinicians in who are from other states not get targeted and to eliminate some of these bounty cases that we're seeing from other states is from what I can understand. So it's lawmakers who are helping the clinicians make sure that they can provide access.
Do we know if people from out of state are coming here to get abortions because of these restrictions? Is there any data on this?
There is. So we do know that people are traveling here. It's not as high as some of those border states that we're seeing because it's a lot further to travel. But Planned Parenthood of Southern New England, which operates here and in it's Connecticut and Rhode Island, they've seen a massive increase. One article I saw noted that they saw a 68% increase in patients coming from 18 states, including as far away as Alabama and Texas. And people are traveling the distance if they are able to. Again, you know, when we talk about this traveling, we have to realize that that's people who have access and wealth and time off from work to do that. So it's an equity issue. But we are seeing a raise, and Planned Parenthood of Northern New England, which is Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire, said it's seen in the last year 6.5% increase in out-of-state patients. So they are traveling to come to the clinics.
I want to take a second to kind of piggyback off of that, and I want to go to Sarah with something. We got a tweet. I don't know if you can help us out with this, but we got a tweet. Our good friends, another show on Connecticut Public, got a tweet at Where We Live. Aaliyah Miller says, is there evidence that younger women aren't taking jobs in so-called red states or going there for higher education because of all that's happening regarding reproductive care? Any idea there, Sarah? Anything you can help us with?
You know, I haven't seen data on that. I have seen some anecdotal reports definitely about, you know, by other journalists. I can't take credit for this reporting, but I've seen some anecdotal reports along those lines, particularly about college selection. It seems to be something that is on young people's minds as they think about where they want to go for college and potentially for employment as well. I think that's one of those questions. It's a really good question, and it's one that we'll get more data on as time goes by. But, you know, it's a question I think is on the minds of a lot of people of reproductive age. You know, I've had friends ask me, if I go to such and such a state and I'm pregnant and something goes wrong, what will happen? You know, and so it's something that women are, and people who can get pregnant certainly think about.
And Sarah, are we seeing things like these safe harbor funds elsewhere in the country?
I haven't seen anything specifically like that. I do know that the state of Maryland has set aside some funding that the governor just released earlier this year for training for abortion providers, with an eye toward the fact that there will be increased need in states with abortion access. I'm not aware of anything specifically like Connecticut's program. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
So, Frankie, can I go back to the question you asked Sarah?
Sure.
There is no data out there yet, but it's actually something I've been thinking about as someone who does research on reproductive health and things like that. And so I think that's going to be something, but, you know, as a professor who works with students, you do hear some of this, and it could be, of course, my students are public health students, so they're a little more in tune to this, but I do think that we are going to see that shift happen, which is, again, another one of those long-term consequences that we're going to have in terms of where people are living and where there's access and what's happening in the states. The divide's going to become a lot deeper if people aren't willing to move to these states. And something that should be linked to this is a lot of the states that are doing the bans are doing a lot of other regressive laws like anti-LGBT. So I think it's not even just the anti-abortion that's going to keep them from moving to these states. It's all the things that are anti-education, anti-stuff. If you're thinking about starting a family and starting your career, there's a lot of laws going in place.
We're going to take a phone call here. It comes from Elaine in Farmington, who has a comment. Go ahead, Elaine. Good morning. Welcome to the Wheelhouse.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay, Frankie?
I can hear you. Sound terrific this morning.
Okay, great. So, you know, first of all, I want to say I really applaud the governor and the attorney general on all the protections they put in place. And I'm very proud of our state and where we're a leader on abortion rights. But, you know, when I heard that New York and Massachusetts months ago were stockpiling mifepristone, I contacted my legislators right away about where Connecticut stood. And I'm still curious why Connecticut has not jumped on that, you know, given our leadership on the issue, and also that at least 50% of abortions, as you folks have mentioned, are, you know, use mifepristone. Does anyone know, are there legitimate concerns as to why Connecticut has not done that? So that's my question, why Connecticut has not jumped in with New York and Massachusetts in stockpiling mifepristone, you know, particularly with FDA concerns and all the rest. Thank you.
It's a great question, Elaine. Thank you for asking it. Thank you for jumping on the show today. Christine, can you help with that?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question. I actually have not asked that and why Connecticut has not done that. But my guess would be that we feel so safe in Connecticut because, again, we codified this in 1990 that there's a little bit of apathy regarding the actions that we need to take because of what's going on nationally. So I just think that it hasn't been an issue here in Connecticut. So we haven't really consumed it in the way that other states have because it's been at the forefront of their minds.
Christine, can we zoom in a little bit more on that Safe Harbor Fund? And as we talk about Connecticut expanding access, one concern I had as I was asking questions to lawmakers this week on the last week of the legislative session in Connecticut is last year they passed the Safe Harbor Fund. This year there's a new budget coming out. There's no money for the Safe Harbor Fund, as I've been told. What are your thoughts about that?
I mean that's where, you know, that's where push comes to shove. So, you know, are you going to make this a priority? And if you are going to make this a priority, then you have to fund this priority. And again, they made the choice not to do that. So that is a choice. A budget is about choices. And so I think that, again, it's this issue that Connecticut still feels that it's kind of safe that it's done this. And I'm going to tell you, it has not been a talking point this year. This has not been an issue that has been talked about at any great length by any of the politicians here in the state at this point.
But a year ago it was, Christine.
A year ago. Yep, a year ago it was, and this year it was not. I want to say that, you know, probably the biggest impact of the abortion debate on the state of Connecticut was that Governor Ned Lamont's choice for the Supreme Court had to withdraw her name from consideration because she signed a letter of endorsement in 2017 for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett.
Thank you so much for that analysis.
That was the biggest impact.
Yeah, and my voice got a little high there. That was by design. But the point was, we're again a year out from this Dobbs decision, and around this time last year at the end of the session, that was really percolating, and there was a big effort publicly, rather, by lawmakers in Connecticut to say that they were going to protect abortion access. So I don't know, how do we square that with this fund not? Obviously, there's still some bills that have been passed this legislative session that'll work to expand access. But I don't know, that fund that was a big part of this last year hasn't been funded yet. I just want to move on to Deb here. So far, we've been talking a lot about the legal barriers to abortion, but I'm wondering, what are some other barriers to access?
So there's a lot of barriers. I mean, one, beyond just the legal piece, it's just a lot of it is the timing. You know, if for us, again, we don't have to worry about it in Connecticut, but in other states with these earlier timeframes, 6 weeks, 15 weeks, you have people who don't know they're pregnant that early. So they're timing out, especially when you look at teens, which are the ones who are most likely to have unplanned pregnancies. They often don't know, having worked in teen pregnancy prevention, they often don't know until they're months in because they're not really paying attention to their cycle. We have equity issues. We have, if you think about the time you need for a lot of people who are low income and may not have sick days, figuring out the timing for traveling to this. There are so many, again, we're seeing the most people impacted are people at low income and people of minority populations. And so there's just so many different pieces. Even if you're in a state that has it, access to transportation, time off, childcare, if you already have children, and while you're not, while you're going through the procedure and in your recovery, if it takes a day or so to recover, depending on whether it was in the clinic or using the medical abortion. So there's a lot of it. There's funding barriers. You may have access to it, but not be able to fully fund it. Although we do, in Connecticut, we have, you know, there's the National Network of Abortion Funds, which helps people pay for it on a national level. And Connecticut has a linked fund, the REACH fund, which is specific for Connecticut. And that will help people who can't afford it. And they pay directly to the clinics to avoid some paperwork and to help protect people. But there's a lot of these issues with access that go beyond the legal piece. And again, this is, it's also thinking about how you go through your medical care. A lot of people struggle to just follow up with regular appointments and understand and have the health literacy to understand the process. If you're trying to figure out the laws and if you meet those requirements and all those pieces, it just adds more barriers to the problem. And so it just becomes this, it just keeps becoming a growing challenge of how do you get this necessary procedure.
Deb, thank you for mentioning the REACH Fund of Connecticut. I want to play a clip from Jessica Puck, who is the co-founder of the REACH Fund of Connecticut, to kind of give an idea of what some of these advocates think about abortion access in Connecticut.
So, yes, here in Connecticut, we are fortunate that, you know, we have the state government on the side of reproductive rights. However, reproductive rights and legality of abortion is the floor. The next step is really making sure that people are able to easily and affordably access the healthcare that they need.
Pivoting away from Connecticut and talking more about national issues, we got a presidential election coming up next year. We only got about 30 to a minute left here in the segment, Sarah. How do you think abortion is going to be talked about in this campaign?
Well, we're already seeing Republicans, I think, sort of struggle a little bit to walk a careful line with this. Many polls suggest over many years that a majority of voters support access to abortion in most or all cases. There is a lot of evidence that some Republicans fear there's a backlash from seeing many of these laws go into effect, the impact they've had on patients. And so Republicans will have to contend with that in the fall and throughout the next year and a half while still appealing to their base.
Sarah McCammon, national correspondent from NPR, thank you for joining us this morning. Deborah Ziske from Southern Connecticut State University and Christine Stewart of CT News Junkie, thank you so much, all of you, for joining us this morning.
Thanks. Frankie.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public. You can join the conversation 888-720-9677. Back after this.
Hi, this is Colin McEnroe. You're listening to a podcast right now. You probably know that. But if you were listening on the air, you'd also know we're in the middle of a fun drive. And even though you're not listening on the air, you're listening to a podcast. That doesn't change the fact that we need your support. And one way that you can support this show that you maybe even love or at least like is to visit ctpublic.org/donate and make a donation today. Thanks for everything that you do already. We are very grateful.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In-Community Speaker Series May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speakerseries.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. Well, today's the day, sine die, the final day of this year's legislative session. Lawmakers have a lot to get through before the clock hits midnight. Later in the conversation, we're going to have a very special guest. But first, we're joined for a preview of the day ahead with my good pal, one half of Frankie and Johnny, Craven, John Craven, political reporter, News 12 Connecticut.
Long time no see. How are you, Frankie?
I'm doing well, and I know you're doing well as well, but I want to make sure I do shamelessly plug that Frankie and Johnny on Fridays at 4:44 on Connecticut Public when I do that, but also do mention that you do fabulous work for News 12 Connecticut. Thank you for coming on, John.
Thank you. The check will be in the mail.
Folks want to join the conversation really quickly. If you have a real quick question, call us 888-720-9677. Before we get into anything specific, how do you think this final day is going to play out? Should we expect
Anything surprising from lawmakers?
No, it's actually going to be kind of anticlimactic. You know, I mean, sometimes you have like some big piece of legislation or the budget is still outstanding on the last day. You know, you have to give a lot of credit to the legislative leaders, House Speaker Matt Ritter and Senate President Marty Looney. They've gotten really good at clock management, to put it in sports terms. So they've gotten really good at getting the big stuff out of the way before the last day, because remember, if you're a Democrat controlling that chamber, if you push big talker bills off to the last day, then your opposition, the Republicans, can, wind down the clock just like you do in a football or a basketball game. So in terms of clock management, I think they've really tried to get the big stuff out of the way, including the budget. So I think today you're going to see a lot of smaller housekeeping bills and maybe final approval of a couple of larger pieces.
Oh, I'm a sucker for talking about clock management, but I'll stay away from that in the final moments of the show here. What some of those issues that you're saying? You're saying there might be some smaller issues. What are we going to see?
Yeah. So like I said, the big stuff has already passed. You know, I think the biggest bill that's still outstanding, and I'm not sure whether it's going to come up for a vote today, are secondary traffic stops. This actually hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but in terms of, criminal justice reform, it's a really big deal. I mean, when you think about deadly police interactions, so many of them have started off with what we call a secondary traffic stop, where you're pulled over for, say, tinted windows or a broken headlight, right? So the ACLU has really been pushing this bill that would ban police from pulling you over just for something like that. It passed the Senate by a pretty wide margin, but it's still awaiting a vote in the House. And so we'll see if Ritter calls that up today, if he even has the votes for it.
Looks like lawmakers finally settling in on a state budget. Brief us on that whole situation. A couple of things coming up with the implementer bill as Republicans tried to weigh in here in the final hours. But nonetheless, a budget went through.
Yeah. And, it was on time and it stayed within the spending caps, which Governor Lamont insisted on. I mean, there's sort of parallel narratives here about this budget, right? I mean, everyone is going to campaign on the fact that they delivered a historic tax cut. And not only is that good for all of us who get a paycheck in Connecticut, you'll keep more of your money, but it's also targeted towards the lower middle class. So the less money you make, the bigger relief you're going to get. That's all good. And the governor really feels like it telegraphs a message that, if you were thinking of escaping Connecticut for lower tax states like Florida, that, we're on the track to making the state more affordable. So that's the positive spin on the budget. But sort of the dark underbelly of it is that you've got dozens, maybe hundreds of local nonprofits that do really critical work. I mean, like crime prevention programs and dealing with folks with disabilities and developmental disabilities. And they've taken a real hit by inflation and the pandemic. And honestly, they got a very, very paltry increase this year, not enough to keep up with inflation and the growing needs. They feel like they're dangerously underfunded. We'll see how that plays out.
I was going to say, because they're probably not happy. I saw Giancarlo Casa, who was very prominent in the nonprofit world in Connecticut, there on the second to last day of the session behind the ropes, still trying to lobby for some more money.
Yeah, I mean, and, it's funny because we talk about crime prevention a lot. And, a lot of these programs really indirectly prevent crime, right? I mean, hunger programs, youth intervention programs. When you give people food to eat and something to do instead of committing crimes, that makes everybody safer. And I think sometimes that gets lost in the budget conversation.
Big points of tension in the budget. Can you just briefly gloss over that? I know tax cuts, everybody's happy about the tax cuts, are seemingly happy, but the points of tension.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Say that again, Frankie?
Points of tension within the budget. I know in the last couple of days, there was some concern that maybe there would be something in the implementer related to this ambitious waste policy that Governor Ned Lamont was hoping to get in there. Obviously, it wasn't in there. But there was also some talk about this Section 62 that had to do with these federal health centers. You know, what kinds of tension do we have in the final days? And then I guess the probably more important ones happen before the final days. What can you tell me about points of tension in the budget?
Yeah, I mean, so the good news is that unlike some past years, they smoothed most of those out. I mean, honestly, for the last week or so, maybe more, we've basically had a budget deal in principle. It's really sort of come down to one or two small sticking points. And the trash issue is the big one you mentioned. I mean, Connecticut phased out landfills many, many years ago and essentially burns, incinerates a lot of its trash. Well, one of the biggest trash incinerators in the state was the Mira plant in Hartford. That shut down, and now we have a real lack of incinerator capacity. So now the state is shipping a lot of garbage off to states like Pennsylvania and Ohio and even Virginia, and that costs a lot of money. The governor really wants to encourage the state to stop, localities to stop shipping so much of it away, and he needs a revenue stream to build a new plant. So he proposed a fee for shipping garbage out of state, that went over like a lead balloon with a lot of the cities and towns, and ultimately it didn't make the budget.
Those tipping fees out of state to go to these out of state landfills could be like $110 a ton. So if you're talking about a lot of tons, maybe 860,000 tons of garbage, oh boy, that's a lot of money. Earlier in the session, there's a lot of talk about the state's housing crisis, but we talked about nonprofits not being happy, housing advocates not happy right now, John.
They are really unhappy. And I got to say, I think you, at the end of the session, they can say that they got a lot done. I think more than maybe they're getting credit for, but housing is the thing that really did not move the needle at all. Part of it was that, they've been negotiating a couple of different zoning ideas behind the scenes for a long time. And the final bill, which was the sort of behemoth aircraft carrier type bill, really didn't come out until the last week of the session. And you knew there was going to be a lot of pushback, especially from some of the Fairfield County suburbs. I really think it just ran out of time for them to get it to a place it needed to be. So, we may see the final version of that passed today in the Senate. It's really watered down from what advocates hoped. But, down here in Fairfield County, where News 12 is, a lot of suburban towns consider that a victory. They really feel like the state should leave local zoning in local hands.
Super quick programming note. We're going to talk about this next month. We're going to zoom in a little bit more on how large lot zoning and exclusionary zoning in Fairfield County impacts the rest of the state. Stay tuned to that July 5 on Connecticut Public. Go to Wheelhouse, ctpublic.org/wheelhouse for more information. Last question I want to ask you, John. A lot of attention paid to Connecticut's dangerous roads. That's because of the absolute tragedy that happened as the session started, the death of Representative Quentin Q. Williams. Very briefly, legislation there, Vision Zero, what do you got on saving dangerous roads here, drivers from dangerous roads?
Yeah, so I think Q. Williams' death really put the spotlight on this and probably moved a lot of legislation that's been stalled for a couple of years now. I mean, the big headline is what passed late last night. Automated speed cameras and red light cameras are coming to Connecticut. Lamont is going to sign this bill. That's going to be a huge change for drivers. They have built in a number of protections. I think the biggest is that they have to give you warning signs before you come up on one. If you've ever gotten nabbed by a speed camera, like in New York or DC, they don't warn you where they're at. And so a lot of times you get a bill in the mail 3 weeks later and you didn't even realize you drove through one. The experience will be different in Connecticut. There will be warning signs. The other thing that they passed, very important, was a wrong-way driving detection system. They've got a few of those on on-ramps now, but this will expand it out to 120 highway on-ramps to prevent the kind of crashes that killed Q. Williams.
Great work covering the session, all legislative session from John Craven. Follow him at JohnCraven1 on Twitter. You'll find some of the best coverage in the state if you go there. I want to make sure we're all over the Capitol, so I asked one more person to join us. What a great participation we've had on the last day of the session from people joining us from the Capitol. I'm going to ask this person to pick up the phone. Well, I guess it's not the phone. They're on Zoom. Chris Polansky joining us now, Connecticut Public breaking news correspondent. Chris, what's happening at the Capitol right now?
Good morning, Frankie. Greetings from the Capitol Press Room. It's pretty quiet ahead of the last day of session, with the notable exception of the 1199 group home workers who have been striking for a few weeks are still striking. They say the budget, while, you know, there was some added into it for them, it still doesn't meet their full demand, so they're still on strike. Otherwise, pretty quiet. Like John said, just tying up some loose ends. We're waiting to see if the governor plans to address a joint session at adjournment later.
20 seconds for you. What do you got? Are you going to be a late night for you? What do you think? You're going to be carrying the ball for us at Connecticut Public?
I think so. The speaker indicates that he thinks he's going to go till midnight.
Tremendous work out of Chris to cover this for us in the last few days. Thank you so much for coming up from Oklahoma to cover this for us and joining us. You've been a great teammate thus far. Chris Polansky, follow at Chris K. Polansky on Twitter for updates today from the Capitol. I'm Frankie Graziano. Today's show produced by Meg Dalton, technical producer Kat Pastor. Thanks to Katie Tolarski for helping us in studio. Jam-packed Wheelhouse today. Download the Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. This is the Wheelhouse. Thanks for listening.